the kidnapper said, and then he told Milton where to leave the money and where to wait for me to be released. Across the lowland downriver plain, Grand Trunk rose before Milton's Cadillac. The train station was still in use in 1975, though just barely. The once opulent terminal was now only a shell. False Amtrak facades concealed the flaking, peeling walls. Most corridors were blocked off. Meanwhile, all around the operative core, the great old building continued to fall into ruin. The Guastavino tiles in the palm court falling, splintering on the ground, the immense barber shop, now a junk room, the skylights caved in, heaped with filth. The office tower attached to the terminal was now a 13-story pigeon coop, all 500 of its windows smashed, as if with diligence. At the same train station my grandparents had arrived a half-century earlier. Lefty and Desdemona, one time only, had revealed their secret here to Sormelina. And now their son, who never learned it, was pulling in behind the station, also secretly. A scene like this, a ransom scene, calls for a noirish mood, shadows, sinister silhouettes, but the sky wasn't cooperating. We were having one of our pink nights. They happened every so often, depending on temperature and the level of chemicals in the air. When particulate matter in the atmosphere was sufficient, light from the ground got trapped and reflected back, and the entire Detroit sky would become the soft pink of cotton candy. It never got dark on pink nights, but the light was nothing like daytime. Our pink nights glowed with the raw luminescence of the night shift, of factories running round the clock. Sometimes the sky would become as bright as Pepto-Bismol, but more often it was a muted, a fabric softener color. Nobody thought it was strange. Nobody said anything about it. We had all grown up with pink nights. They were not a natural phenomenon, but they were natural to us. Under this strange nocturnal sky, Milton pulled his car as close to the train platform as possible and stopped. He shut off the engine. Taking the briefcase, he got out into the still, crystalline winter air of Michigan. All the world was frozen, the distant trees, the telephone lines, the grass in the yards of the downriver houses, the ground itself. Out on the river, a freighter bellowed. Here there were no sounds. The station, completely deserted at night. Milton had on his tasseled black loafers. Dressing in the dark, he had decided they were the easiest to slip on. He was also wearing his car coat, beige and dingy, with a muff of fur at the collar. Against the cold, he had worn a hat, a gray felt borsalino, with a red feather in the black band. An old-timer's hat now in 1975. With hat, briefcase, and loafers, Milton might have been on his way to work, and certainly he was walking quickly. He climbed the metal steps to the train platform. He headed along it, looking for the trash can where he was supposed to drop the briefcase. The kidnapper said it would have an X chalked on the lid. Milton hurried along the platform, the tassels of his loafers bouncing, the tiny feather in his hat rippling in the cold wind. It would not be strictly truthful to say that he was afraid. Milton Stefanides did not admit to being afraid. The physiological manifestations of fear, the racing heart, the torched armpits, went on in him without official acknowledgement. He wasn't alone among his generation in this. There were lots of fathers who shouted when they were afraid or scolded their children to deflect blame from themselves. It's possible that such qualities were indispensable in the generation that won the war. A lack of introspection was good for bolstering your courage, but in the last months and weeks, it had done damage to Milton. Throughout my disappearance, Milton had kept up a brave front while doubts worked invisibly inside him. He was like a statue being chiseled away from the inside, hollowed out. As more and more of his thoughts gave him pain, Milton had increasingly avoided them. Instead, he concentrated on the few that made him feel better, the bromides about everything working out. Milton, quite simply, had ceased to think things through. What was he doing out there on the dark train platform? Why did he go out there alone? We would never be able to explain it adequately. It didn't take him long to find the trash can marked with chalk. Swiftly, Milton lifted its triangular green lid and laid the briefcase inside, but when he tried to pull his arm back out, something wouldn't let him. It was his hand. Since Milton had stopped thinking things through, his body was now doing the work for him. His hand seemed to be saying something. It was voicing reservations. "What if the kidnapper doesn't set Callie free?" the hand was saying, but Milton answered, "There's no time to think about that now." Again, he tried to pull his arm out of the trash can, but his hand stubbornly resisted. "What if the kidnapper takes this money and then asks for more?" asked the hand. "That's the chance we'll have to take," Milton snapped back, and with all his strength pulled his arm out of the trash can. His hand lost its grip. The briefcase fell into the refuse inside. Milton hurried back across the platform, dragging his hand with him, and got into the Cadillac. He started the engine. He turned on the heat, warming the car up for me. He leaned forward, staring through the windshield, expecting me to appear any minute. His hand was still smarting, muttering to itself. Milton thought about the briefcase lying out in the trash can, his mind filled with the image of money inside, 25 grand. He saw the individual stacks of $100 bills, the repeating face of Benjamin Franklin in the doubled mirrors of all that cash. Milton's throat went dry. A spasm of anxiety known to all depression babies gripped his body, and in the next second, he was jumping out of the car again, running back to the platform. This guy wanted to do business? Then Milton would show him how to do business. He wanted to negotiate. How about this? Milton was climbing the steps now, loafers ringing against the metal. Instead of leaving $25,000, why not leave $12,500? This way I'll have some leverage, half now, half later. Why hadn't he thought of this before? What the hell was the matter with him? He was under too much strain. No sooner had he reached the platform, however, then my father stopped cold. Less than 20 yards away, a dark figure in a stocking cap was reaching into the trash can. Milton's blood froze. He didn't know whether to retreat or advance. The kidnapper tried to pull the briefcase out, but it wouldn't fit through the swinging door. He went behind the can and lifted up the entire metal lid. In the chemical brightness, Milton saw the patriarchal beard, the pale, waxen cheeks, and, most tellingly, the tiny 5'4" frame. Father Mike! Father Mike! Father Mike was the kidnapper? Impossible! Incredible! But there was no doubt. Standing on the platform was the man who had once been engaged to my mother and who, at my father's hands, had had her stolen away. Taking the ransom was the former seminarian who had married Milton's sister Zoe instead, a choice that had sentenced him to a life of invidious comparisons, of Zoe always asking why he hadn't invested in the stock market when Milton had, or bought gold when Milton had, or stashed money away in the Cayman Islands as Milton had, a choice that had condemned Father Mike to being a poor relation, forced to endure Milton's lack of respect while accepting his hospitality and compelling him to carry a dining room chair into the living room if he wanted to sit. Yes, it was a great shock for Milton to discover his brother-in-law on the train platform, but it also made sense. It was clear now why the kidnapper had wanted to haggle over the price, why he wanted to feel like a businessman for once, and alas, how he had known about Vithinios. Explained, too, were why the telephone calls had come on Sundays, whenever Tessie was at church, and the music in the background, which Milton now identified as the priests chanting the liturgy. Long ago, my father had stolen Father Mike's fiancée and married her himself. The child of the union, me, had poured salt in the wound by baptizing the priest in reverse. Now Father Mike was trying to get even. But not if Milton could help it. "Hey!" he shouted, putting his hands on his hips. "Just what the hell are you trying to pull, Mike?" Father Mike didn't answer. He looked up and, out of priestly habit, smiled benignantly at Milton. his white teeth appearing in the great bush of black beard, but already he was backing away, stepping on crushed cups and other litter, hugging the briefcase to his chest like a packed parachute. Three or four steps backward, smiling that gentle smile before he turned and fled in earnest. He was small but quick. Like a shot, he disappeared down a set of stairs on the other side of the platform. In pink light, Milton saw him crossing the train tracks to his car, a bright green, Grecian green, according to the catalog, fuel-efficient, AMC Gremlin, and Milton ran back to the Cadillac to follow him. It wasn't like a car chase in the movies. There was no swerving, no near collisions. It was, after all, a car chase between a Greek Orthodox priest and a middle-aged Republican. As they sped, relatively speaking, away from Grand Trunk, heading in the direction of the river, Father Mike and Milton never exceeded the limit by more than 10 miles per hour. Father Mike didn't want to attract the police. Milton, realizing that his brother-in-law had nowhere to go, was content to follow him to the water, so they went along in their pokey fashion, the weirdly shaped gremlin making rolling stops at traffic signs in the El Dorado a little bit later, doing the same, down nameless streets, past junk houses, across a dead-end piece of land created by the freeways and the river. Father Mike unwisely attempted to escape. It was just like always. Aunt Zoe should have been there to holler at Father Mike, because only an idiot would have headed toward the river instead of the highway. Every street he could possibly take would go nowhere. "I got you now," Milton exulted. The gremlin made a right. The El Dorado made a right. The gremlin made a left, and so did the Cadillac. Milton's tank was full. He could track Father Mike all night if he had to. Feeling confident, Milton adjusted the heat, which was a little too high. He turned on the radio. He let a little more space get between the gremlin and the El Dorado. When he looked up again, the gremlin was making another right. 30 seconds later, when Milton turned the same corner, he saw the sweeping expanse of the Ambassador Bridge, and his confidence crumbled. This was not just like always. Tonight, his brother-in-law, the priest, who spent his life in the fairy tale world of the church, dressed up like Liberace, had figured things out for once. As soon as Milton saw the bridge strung like a giant glittering harp over the river, panic seized his soul. With horror, Milton understood Father Mike's plan. As Chapter 11 had intended, when he threatened to dodge the draft, Father Mike was heading for Canada. Like Jimmy Zizmo the bootlegger, he was heading for the lawless liberal hideaway to the north. He was planning to take the money out of the country. And he was no longer going slow. Yes, despite its thimble-sized engine that sounded like a sewing machine, the gremlin was managing to accelerate. Leaving the no-man's land around Grand Trunk Station, it had now entered the bright, customs-controlled, high-traffic area of the United States-Canada border. Tall, carbon gas streetlights irradiated the gremlin, whose bright green color now looked even more acid than ever. Putting distance between itself and the El Dorado, like the Joker's car getting away from the Batmobile, the gremlin joined the trucks and cars converging around the entrance to the great suspension bridge. Milton stepped on it. The huge engine of the Cadillac roared. White smoke spumed from the tailpipe. At this point, the two cars had become exactly what cars are supposed to be. They were extensions of their owners. The gremlin was small and nimble as Father Mike was. It disappeared and reappeared in traffic, much as he did behind the icon screen at church. The El Dorado, substantial and boat-like, as was Milton, proved difficult to maneuver in the late-night bridge traffic. There were huge semis. There were passenger cars heading for the casinos and strip clubs in Windsor. In all this traffic, Milton lost sight of the gremlin. He pulled into a line and waited. Suddenly, 6 cars ahead, he saw Father Mike dart out of line, cutting off another car and slipping into a toll booth. Milton rolled down his automatic window. Sticking his head out into the cold, exhaust-clouded air, he shouted, "Stop that man! He's got my money!" The customs officer didn't hear him, however. Milton could see the officer asking Father Mike a few questions and then, No, stop! He was waving Father Mike through. At that point, Milton started hammering on his horn. The blasts erupting from beneath the Eldorado's hood might have been emanating from Milton's own chest. His blood pressure was surging, and inside his car coat, his body began to drip with sweat. He had been confident of bringing Father Mike to justice in the U.S. courts, but who knew what would happen once he got to Canada? Canada, with its pacifism and its socialized medicine. Canada, with its millions of French speakers. It was like a foreign country. Father Mike might become a fugitive over there, living it up in Quebec. He might disappear into Saskatchewan and roam with the moose. It wasn't only losing the money that enraged Milton. In addition to absconding with $25,000 and giving Milton false hopes of my return, Father Mike was abandoning his own family. Brotherly protectiveness mixed with financial and paternal pain in Milton's heaving breast. "You don't do this to my sister, you hear me?" Milton fruitlessly shouted from the driver's seat of his huge boxed-in car. Next, he called after Father Mike. "Hey, dumbass, haven't you ever heard of commissions? Soon as you change that money, you're going to lose 5%. Fulminating at the wheel, his progress curtailed by semis in front and strip clubbers behind, Milton squirmed and hollered, his fury unbearable. My father's honking hadn't gone unnoticed, however. Customs agents were used to the horn blowing of impatient drivers. They had a way of handling them. As soon as Milton pulled up to the booth, the official signaled him to pull over. Through his open window, Milton shouted, "There's a guy who just came through. He stole some money of mine. Can you have him stopped at the other end? He's driving a gremlin. Pull your car over there, sir." "He stole $25,000. "We can talk about that as soon as you pull over and get out of your car, sir." "He's trying to take it out of the country," Milton explained one last time, but the customs agent continued to direct him to the inspection area. Finally, Milton gave up. Withdrawing his face from the open window, he took hold of the steering wheel and obediently began pulling over to the empty lane. As soon as he was clear of the customs booth, however, he stomped a tassel loafer down on the accelerator and the squealing Cadillac rocketed away. Now it was something like a car chase, for out on the bridge, Father Mike, too, had stepped on the gas. Snaking between the cars and trucks, he was racing toward the International Divide, while Milton pursued, flashing his brights to get people out of the way. The bridge rose up over the river in a graceful parabola, its steel cables strung with red lights. The Cadillac's tires hummed over its striated surface. Milton had his foot to the floor, engaging what he called the goose gear, and now the difference between a luxury automobile and a newfangled cartoon car began to show itself. The Cadillac engine roared with power. Its eight cylinders fired, the carburetor sucking in vast quantities of fuel, the pistons thumped and jumped, and the drive wheel spun like mad as the long superhero car passed others as if they were standing still. Seeing the Eldorado coming so fast, other drivers moved aside. Milton cut straight through the traffic until he spotted the green gremlin up ahead. "So much for your high gas mileage," Milton cried. "Sometimes you need a little power." By this time, Father Mike saw the Eldorado looming too. He floored the accelerator, but the gremlin's engine was already working at capacity. The car vibrated wildly, but picked up no speed. On and on came the Cadillac. Milton didn't take his foot off the pedal until his front bumper was nearly touching the gremlin's rear. They were traveling now at 70 miles per hour. Father Mike looked up to see Milton's avenging eyes filling the rearview mirror. Milton, gazing ahead into the gremlin's interior, saw a slice of Father Mike's face. The priest seemed to be asking for forgiveness or explaining his actions. There was a strange sadness in his eyes, a weakness which Milton could not interpret. And now I have to enter Father Mike's head, I'm afraid. I feel myself being sucked in and I can't resist. The front part of his mind is a whirl of fear, greed, and desperate thoughts of escape, all to be expected. But going deeper in, I discover things about him I never knew. There's no serenity, for instance, none at all, no closeness to God. The gentleness Father Mike had, his smiling silence at family meals, the way he would bend down to be face to face with children, not far for him, but still. All these attributes existed apart from any communication with the transcendent realm. They were just a passive-aggressive method of survival, the result of having a wife with a voice as loud as Enzo's. Yes, echoing inside Father Mike's head is all the shouting Aunt Zoe has done over the years, ever since she was pregnant nonstop in Greece without a washer or dryer. I can hear, "Do you call this a life?" And, "If you've got the ear of God, tell him to send me a check for the drapes." And, "Maybe the Catholics have the right idea. Priests shouldn't have families." At church, Michael Antoniou is called Father. He is deferred to, catered to. At church, he has the power to forgive sins and consecrate the host. But as soon as he steps through the front door of their duplex in Harper Woods, Father Mike suffers an immediate drop in status. At home, he is nobody. At home, he's bossed around, complained about, ignored. And so, it was not so difficult to see why Father Mike decided to flee his marriage, and why he needed money, none of which, however, could Milton read in his brother-in-law's eyes. And in the next moment, those eyes changed again. Father Mike had shifted his gaze back to the road, where they met a terrifying sight. The red brake lights of the car in front of him were flashing. Father Mike was going much too fast to stop in time. He stomped on his brakes, but it was too late. The Grecian green gremlin slammed into the car ahead. The Eldorado came next. Milton braced himself for the impact, but it was then an amazing thing happened. He heard metal crunching and glass shattering, but this was coming from the cars ahead. As for the Cadillac itself, it never stopped moving forward. It climbed right up Father Mike's car. The weird, slanted back end of the gremlin acted as a kind of ramp, and in the next second, Milton realized he was airborne. The midnight blue Eldorado rose above the accident on the bridge. It sailed up over the guardrails, through the cables, plunging off the middle span of the Ambassador Bridge. The Eldorado fell hood first, gathering speed. Through the tinted windshield, Milton could see the Detroit River below, but only briefly. In those last seconds, as life prepared to leave his body, it withdrew its laws too. Instead of falling into the river, the Cadillac swooped upward and leveled itself. Milton was surprised, but very pleased. He didn't remember the salesman having mentioned anything about a flight feature. Even better, Milton hadn't paid extra for it. As the car floated away from the bridge, he was smiling. "Now, this is what I call an air ride," he said to himself. The Eldorado was flying high above the river, wasting who knew how much gas. The sky outside was pink, while the lights on the dashboard were green. There were all sorts of switches and gauges. Milton had never noticed most of them before. It looked more like an airplane cockpit than a car. And Milton was at the controls. Milton was flying his last Cadillac over the Detroit River. It didn't matter what eyewitnesses saw, or that the newspapers reported the next day that the Cadillac was part of the 10-car pileup on the bridge. Sitting back in the comfortable leather bucket seat, Milton Stefanides could see the downtown skyline approaching. Music was playing on the radio, an old Artie Shaw tune. Why not? And Milton watched the red light on the Penobscot building blinking on and off. After a certain amount of trial and error, he learned how to steer the flying car. It wasn't a matter of turning the wheel, but of willing it, as in a lucid dream. Milton brought the car in overland. He passed above Cobo Hall. He circled the top of the Paunch, where he had once taken me to lunch. For some reason, Milton was no longer afraid of heights. He guessed that this was because his death was imminent. There was nothing left to fear. Without vertigo or perspiration, he gazed down at Grand Circus Park until he spotted what was left of the wheels of Detroit, and after that he headed for the west side to look for the old zebra room. Back on the bridge, my father's head had been crushed against the steering wheel. The detective, who later informed my mother of the accident, when asked about the condition of Milton's body, said only, "It was consistent with the crash of a vehicle going at 70-plus miles an hour." Milton no longer had any brainwaves, so it was understandable why, hovering in the Cadillac, he might have forgotten that the zebra room had burned down long ago. He was mystified at not being able to find it. All that was left of the old neighborhood was empty land. It seemed that most of the city was gone as he gazed down. Empty lot followed empty lot. But Milton was wrong about this, too. Corn was sprouting up in some places, and grass was coming back. It looked like farmland down there.
"Might as well give it back to the Indians," Milton thought. "Maybe the Potawatomis would want it. They could put up a casino."
The sky had turned to cotton candy, and the city had become a plain again. But another red light was blinking now. Not on the Penobscot building inside the car. It was one of the gauges Milton had never seen before. He knew what it indicated. At that moment, Milton began to cry. All of a sudden, his face was wet, and he touched it, sniffling and weeping. He slumped back, and because no one was there to see, he opened his mouth to give outlet to his overpowering grief. He hadn't cried since he was a boy. The sound of his deep voice crying surprised him. It was the sound of a bear, wounded or dying. Milton bellowed in the Cadillac as the car began once again to descend. He was crying not because he was about to die, but because I, Calliope, was still gone. Because he had failed to save me. Because he had done everything he could to get me back. And still, I was missing. As the car tipped its nose down, the river appeared again. Milton Stephanides, an old Navy man, prepared to meet it. Right at the end, he was no longer thinking about me. I have to be honest and record Milton's thoughts as they occurred to him. At the very end, he wasn't thinking about me or Tessie or any of us. There was no time. As the car plunged, Milton only had time to be astonished by the way things had turned out. All his life, he had lectured everybody about the right way to do things, and now he had done this, the stupidest thing ever. He could hardly believe he had loused things up quite so badly. His last word, therefore, was spoken softly. Without anger or fear, only with bewilderment and a measure of bravery.
"Bird brain," Milton said to himself in his last Cadillac, and then the water claimed him.
A real Greek might end on this tragic note, but an American is inclined to stay upbeat. These days, whenever we talk about Milton, my mother and I come to the conclusion that he got out just in time. He got out before Chapter 11, taking over the family business, ran it into the ground in less than 5 years. Before Chapter 11, in a reprise of Desdemona's gender prognostications, began wearing a tiny silver spoon around his neck. He got out before the draining of bank accounts and the jacking up of credit cards, before Tessie was forced to sell Middlesex and move down to Florida with Aunt Zoe. And he got out 3 months before Cadillac, in April 1975, introduced the Seville, a fuel-efficient model that looked as though it had lost its pants, after which Cadillacs were never the same. Milton got out before many of the things that I will not include in this story because they are the common tragedies of American life, and as such do not fit into this singular and uncommon record. He got out before the Cold War ended, before missile shields and global warming and September 11th, and a second president with only one vowel in his name.
Most important, Milton got out without ever seeing me again. That would not have been easy. I like to think that my father's love for me was strong enough that he could have accepted me, but in some ways it's better that we never had to work that out, he and I. With respect to my father, I will always remain a girl. There's a kind of purity in that, the purity of childhood. The last stop.
It sort of still applies, said Julie Kikuchi. It does not, I said. It's in the same ballpark. What I told you about myself has nothing whatsoever to do with being gay or closeted. I've always liked girls. I liked girls when I was a girl.
I wouldn't be some kind of last stop for you.
More like a first stop.
Julie laughed. She still had not made a decision. I waited. Then at last she said, all right.
All right, I asked.
She nodded.
All right, I said.
So we left the museum and went back to my apartment. We had another drink. We slow danced in the living room. And then I led Julie into the bedroom, where I hadn't led anyone in quite a long time. She switched off the lights.
Wait a minute, I said. Are you turning off the lights because of you or because of me?
Because of me.
Why?
Because I'm a shy, modest Oriental lady. Just don't expect me to bathe you.
No bathing?
Not unless you do a Zorba dance.
Where did I put that bouzouki of mine anyway?
I was trying to keep up the banter. I was also taking off my clothes. So was Julie. It was like jumping into cold water. You had to do it without thinking too much. We got under the covers and held each other, petrified, happy.
I might be your last stop, too, I said, clinging to her.
Did you ever think of that? And Julie Kikuchi answered, it crossed my mind.
Chapter 11 flew to San Francisco to collect me from jail. My mother had to sign a letter requesting that the police release me into my brother's custody. A trial date would be set in the near future, but as a juvenile and first-time offender, I was likely to receive only probation. The offense came off my record, never interfering with my subsequent job prospects at the State Department. Not that I concerned myself with these details at the time. I was too stunned, sick with grief poisons, and wanted to go home. When I came out into the outer police station, my brother was sitting alone on a long wooden bench. He looked up at me with no expression, blinking. That was Chapter 11's way. Everything went on in him internally. Inside his brain case, sensations were being reviewed, evaluated, before any official reaction was given. I was used to this, of course. What is more natural than the tics and habits of one's close relatives? Years ago, Chapter 11 had made me pull down my underpants so that he could look at me. Now his eyes were raised, but no less riveted. He was taking in my deforested face. He was getting a load of the funereal suit. It was a lucky thing that my brother had taken as much LSD as he had. Chapter 11 had gone in early for mind expansion. He contemplated the veil of Maya, the existence of various planes of being. For a personality thus prepared, it was somewhat easier to deal with your sister becoming your brother. There have been hermaphrodites like me since the world began. But as I came out from my holding pen, it was possible that no generation other than my brother's was as well disposed to accept me. Still, it was not nothing to witness me so changed. Chapter 11's eyes widened. We hadn't seen each other for over a year. Chapter 11 had changed, too. His hair was shorter. It had receded farther. His friend's girlfriend had given him a home perm. Chapter 11's previously lank hair was now leonine in back while the front retreated. He didn't look like John Lennon anymore. Gone were his faded bell-bottoms, his granny glasses. Now he wore brown hip-huggers. His wide lapel shirt shimmered under the fluorescent lights. The 60s have never really come to an end. They're still going on right now in Goa. But by 1975, the 60s had finally ended for my brother. At any other time, we would have lingered over these details, but we didn't have the luxury for that. I came across the room. Chapter 11 stood up, and then we were hugging, swaying. "Dad's dead," my brother repeated in my ear. "He's dead." I asked him what had happened, and he told me. Milton had charged through customs. Father Mike had also been on the bridge. He was now in the hospital. Milton's old briefcase had been found in the wreckage of the Gremlin, full of money. Father Mike had confessed everything to the police, the kidnapping ruse, the ransom. When this had sunk in, I asked, "How's Mom?"
"Ah, she's all right. She's holding up. She's pissed at Milt.
Pissed? For going out there, for not telling her. She's glad you're coming home. That's what she's focusing on. You coming back for the funeral. So that's good." We were scheduled to take the red eye out that night. The funeral was the next morning. Chapter 11 had been dealing with the bureaucratic side of things, getting the death certificates and placing the obituaries. He asked me nothing about my time in San Francisco or at 69ers. Only when we were on the plane and Chapter 11 had had a few beers did he allude to my condition.
"So, I guess I can't call you Callie anymore.
Call me whatever you want.
How about bro?
Fine with me." He was quiet, blinking. There was the usual lag time while he thought.
"I never heard much about what happened out there at that clinic. I was up in Marquette. I wasn't talking to Mom and Dad that much.
I ran away."
"Why?"
"They were going to cut me up." I could feel him staring at me with that outer glaze that concealed considerable mental activity.
"It's a little bit weird for me," he said.
"It's weird for me, too."
A moment later, he let out a laugh.
"Weird. Pretty fucking weird."
I was shaking my head in comic despair. "You can say that again, bro."
Confronted with the impossible, there was no option but to treat it as normal. We didn't have an upper register, so to speak, but only the middle range of our shared experience and ways of behaving, of joking around. But it got us through.
"One good thing about this gene I have, though," I said.
"What?"
"I'll never go bald."
"Why not?"
"You have to have DHT to go bald."
"Huh?" said Chapter 11, feeling his scalp.
"I guess I'm a little heavy on the DHT. I guess I'm what they'd call DHT rich."
We reached Detroit a little after 6 a.m. The smashed-up Eldorado had been towed to a police yard. Waiting in the airport parking lot was our mother's car, the Florida Special. The lemon-colored Cadillac was all we had left of Milton. It was already beginning to take on the attributes of a relic. The driver's seat was sunken from the weight of his body. You could see the impression of Milton's cloven backside in the leather upholstery. Tessie filled this hollow with throw pillows in order to see over the steering wheel. Chapter 11 had tossed the pillows into the back seat. In the unseasonal car, with its powerful air conditioning switched off and sunroof closed, we started for home. We passed the giant Uniroyal tire and the thready woods of Inkster.
"What time's the funeral?" I asked.
11. It was just getting light. The sun was rising from wherever it rose, behind the distant factories, maybe, or over the blind river. The growing light was like a leakage or flood seeping into the ground. "Go through downtown," I told my brother.
"It'll take too long.
We've got time. I want to see it." Chapter 11 obliged me. We took I-94 past River Rouge and Olympia Stadium and then curled in toward the river on the Lodge Freeway and entered the city from the north. Grow up in Detroit and you understand the way of all things. Early on, you are put on close relations with entropy. As we rose out of the highway trough, we could see the condemned houses, many burned, as well as the stark beauty of all the vacant lots, gray and frozen. Once elegant apartment buildings stood next to scrapyards, and where there had been furriers and movie palaces, there were now blood banks and methadone clinics and Mother Waddle's perpetual mission. Returning to Detroit from bright climes usually depressed me, but now I welcomed it. The blight eased the pain of my father's death, making it seem like a general state of affairs. At least the city didn't mock my grief by being sparkling or winsome. Downtown looked the same, only emptier. You couldn't knock down the skyscrapers when the tenants left, so instead, boards went over the windows and doors, and the great shelves of commerce were put in cold storage. On the riverfront, the Renaissance Center was being built, inaugurating a Renaissance that has never arrived. "Let's go through Greektown," I said. Again, my brother humored me. Soon we came down the block of restaurants and souvenir stores. Amid the ethnic kitsch, there were still a few authentic coffee houses patronized by old men in their 70s and 80s. Some were already up this morning, drinking coffee, playing backgammon, and reading the Greek newspapers. When these old men died, the coffee houses would suffer and finally close. Little by little, the restaurants on the block would suffer too, their awnings getting ripped, the big yellow light bulbs on the Lakin marquee burning out, the Greek bakery on the corner being taken over by South Yemenis from Dearborn. But all that hadn't happened yet. On Monroe Street, we passed the Grecian Gardens, where we had held Lefty's Macaria. "Are we having a Macaria for Dad?" I asked. "Yeah, the whole deal." "Where?" "At the Grecian Gardens." Chapter 11 laughed. "You kidding? Nobody wanted to come down here." "I like it here," I said. "I love Detroit." "Yeah? Well, welcome home." He had turned back onto Jefferson for the long miles through the blighted east side. A wig shop, vanity dancing, the old club now for rent, a used record store with a hand-painted sign showing people grooving amid an explosion of musical notes. The old dime stores and the sweet shops were closed. Kresge's, Woolworth's, Sanders Ice Cream. It was cold out. Not many people were on the streets. On one corner, a man stood impervious, cutting a fine figure against the winter sky. His leather coat reached to his ankles. Space funk goggles wrapped around his dignified, long-jawed head, on top of which sat, or sailed, really, the Spanish galleon of a velvet maroon hat. Not part of my suburban world, this figure, therefore exotic, but nevertheless familiar and suggestive of the peculiar creative energies of my hometown. I was glad to see him anyway. I couldn't take my eyes away. When I was little, street corner dudes like that would sometimes lower their shades to wink, keen on getting a rise out of the white girl in the back seat passing by. But now the dude gave me a different look altogether. He didn't lower his sunglasses, but his mouth, his flared nostrils, and the tilt of his head communicated defiance and even hate. That was when I realized a shocking thing. I couldn't become a man without becoming the man, even if I didn't want to. I made Chapter 11 go through Indian Village, passing our old house. I wanted to take a nostalgia bath, to calm my nerves before seeing my mother. The streets were still full of trees, bare in winter, so that we could see all the way to the frozen river. I was thinking how amazing it was that the world contained so many lives. Out in these streets, people were embroiled in a thousand matters. Money problems, love problems, school problems. People were falling in love, getting married, going to drug rehab, learning how to ice skate, getting bifocals, studying for exams, trying on clothes, getting their hair cut, and getting born. And in some houses, people were getting old and sick and were dying, leaving others to grieve. It was happening all the time, unnoticed. And it was the thing that really mattered. What really mattered in life, what gave it weight, was death. Seen this way, my bodily metamorphosis was a small event. Only the pimp might have been interested. Soon we reached Grosse Pointe. The naked elms reached across our street from both sides, touching fingertips, and snow lay crusted in the flower beds before the warm, hibernatory houses. My body was reacting to the sight of home. Happy sparks were shooting off inside me. It was a canine feeling, full of eager love and dumb to tragedy. Here was my home, Middlesex. up there in that window, on the tiled window seat. I used to read for hours, eating mulberries off the tree outside. The driveway hadn't been shoveled. Nobody had had time to think about that. Chapter 11 took the driveway a little fast, and we bounced in our seats, the tailpipe hitting. After we got out of the car, he opened the trunk and began carrying my suitcase to the house, but halfway there he stopped. "Hey, bro," he said, "you can carry this yourself." He was smiling with mischief. You could see he was enjoying the paradigm shift. He was taking my metamorphosis as a brain teaser, like the ones in the back of his sci-fi magazines. "Let's not get carried away," I answered. "Feel free to carry my luggage any time." "Catch," shouted Chapter 11, and hefted the suitcase. I caught it staggering back. Right then, the door of the house opened, and my mother, in house slippers, stepped out into the frost-powdery air. Tessie Stefanides, who in a different lifetime, when space travel was new, had decided to go along with her husband and create a girl by devious means, now saw before her in the snowy driveway the fruit of that scheme. Not a daughter at all anymore, but at least by looks, a son. She was tired and heartsick and had no energy to deal with this new event. It was not acceptable that I was now living as a male person. Tessie didn't think it should be up to me. She had given birth to me and nursed me and brought me up. She had known me before I knew myself. And now she had no say in the matter. Life started out one thing and then suddenly turned a corner and became something else. Tessie didn't know how this had happened. Though she still could see Calliope in my face, each feature seemed changed, thickened, and there were whiskers on my chin and above my upper lip. There was a criminal aspect to my appearance in Tessie's eyes. She couldn't help herself thinking that my arrival was part of some settling of accounts, that Milton had been punished, and that her punishment was just beginning. For all these reasons, she stood still, red-eyed, in the doorway. "Hi, Mom," I said. "I'm home." I went forward to meet her. I set down my suitcase, and when I looked up again, Tessie's face had altered. She had been preparing for this moment for months. Now her faint eyebrows lifted, the corners of her mouth rose, crinkling the wan cheeks. Her expression was that of a mother watching a doctor remove bandages from a severely burned child, an optimistic, dishonest, bedside face. Still, it told me all I needed to know. Tessie was going to try to accept things. She felt crushed by what had happened to me, but she was going to endure it for my sake. We embraced. Tall as I was, I laid my head on my mother's shoulder, and she stroked my hair while I sobbed. "Why?" she kept crying softly, shaking her head. "Why?" I thought she was talking about Milton, but then she clarified. "Why did you run away, honey?" "I had to. Don't you think it would have been easier just to stay the way you were?" I lifted my face and looked into my mother's eyes, and I told her, "This is the way I was." You will want to know, how did we get used to things? What happened to our memories? Did Calliope have to die in order to make room for Cal? To all these questions, I offer the same truism. It's amazing what you can get used to. After I returned from San Francisco and started living as a male, my family found that, contrary to popular opinion, gender was not all that important. My change from girl to boy was far less dramatic than the distance anybody travels from infancy to adulthood. In most ways, I remained the person I'd always been. Even now, though I live as a man, I remain, in essential ways, Tessie's daughter. I'm still the one who remembers to call her every Sunday. I'm the one she recounts her growing list of ailments to, like any good daughter. I'll be the one to nurse her in her old age. We still discuss what's wrong with men. We still, on visits back home, have our hair done together. Bowing to the changing times, the Golden Fleece now cuts men's hair as well as women's. and I finally let dear old Sophie give me that short haircut she always wanted. But all that came later. Right then, we were in a hurry. It was almost 10. The limousine from the funeral parlor would be arriving in 35 minutes. "You better get cleaned up," Tessie said to me. The funeral did what funerals are supposed to do. It gave us no time to dwell on our feelings. Hooking her arm in mine, Tessie led me into the house. Middlesex, too, was in mourning. The mirror in the den was covered by a black cloth. There were black streamers on the sliding doors, all the old immigrant touches. Aside from that, the house seemed unnaturally still and dim. As always, the enormous windows brought the outdoors in so that it was winter in the living room. Snow lay all around us. "I guess you can wear that suit," Chapter 11 said to me. "It looks pretty appropriate." "I doubt you even have a suit." "I don't. I didn't go to a stuck-up private school. Where did you get that thing anyway? It smells." "At least it's a suit." While my brother and I teased each other, Tessie watched closely. She was picking up the cue from my brother that this thing that had happened to me might be handled lightly. She wasn't sure she could do this herself, but she was watching how the younger generation pulled it off. Suddenly, there was a strange noise, like an eagle's cry. The intercom on the living room wall crackled. A voice shrieked, "Yoo-hoo! Tessie, honey!" The immigrant touches, of course, weren't around the house because of Tessie. The person shrieking over the intercom was none other than Desdemona. Patient reader, you may have been wondering what happened to my grandmother. You may have noticed that shortly after she climbed into bed forever, Desdemona began to fade away. But that was intentional. I allowed Desdemona to slip out of my narrative because, to be honest, in the dramatic years of my transformation, she slipped out of my attention most of the time. For the last 5 years, she had remained bedridden in the guest house. During my time at Baker and Inglis, while I was falling in love with the object, I had remained aware of my grandmother only in the vaguest of ways. I saw Tessie preparing her meals and carrying trays out to the guest house. Every evening, I saw my father make a dutiful visit to her perpetual sick room with its hot water bottles and pharmaceutical supplies. At those times, Milton spoke to his mother in Greek with increasing difficulty. During the war, Desdemona had failed to teach her son to write Greek. Now, in her old age, she recognized with horror that he was forgetting how to speak it as well. Occasionally, I brought Desdemona's food trays out and for a few minutes would reacquaint myself with her time capsule life. The framed photograph of the burial plot still stood on her bedside table for reassurance. Tessie went to the intercom. "Yes, Yaya," she said. "Did you need something?"
"My feet! They are terrible today. Did you get the Epsom salts?"
"Yes, I'll bring them to you."
"My God, no, let Yaya die, Tessie. Everybody's dead. Everybody but Yaya. Yaya, she is too old to live now. And what does God do? Nothing."
"Are you finished with your breakfast?"
"Yes, thank you, honey. But the prunes, they were not good ones today."
"Those are the same prunes you always have."
"Something. Maybe it happened to them. Get a new box, please, Tessie. The sun kissed."
"I will."
"Okay, honey moo. Thank you, honey."
My mother silenced the intercom and turned back to me. "Yaya's not doing so good anymore. Her mind's going. Since you've been away, she's really gone downhill." We told her about Milt. Tessie faltered near tears.
"About what happened? Yaya couldn't stop crying. I thought she was going to die, right then and there. And then a few hours later, she asked me where Milt was. She forgot the entire thing. Maybe it's better that way."
"Is she going to the funeral?"
"She can barely walk. Mrs. Papanicolas is coming to watch her. She doesn't know where she is half the time." Tessie smiled sadly, shaking her head. "Who would have thought she would outlive Milt?" She teared up again and forced the tears back.
"Can I go and see her?"
You want to?
Yes. Tessie looked apprehensive.
What will you tell her?
What should I tell her? For another few seconds, my mother was silent, thinking. Then she shrugged. It doesn't matter. Whatever you say, she won't remember. Take this out to her. She wants to soak her feet.
Carrying the Epsom salts and a piece of the baklava wrapped in cellophane, I came out of the house and walked along the portico past the courtyard and bathhouse to the guest house behind. The door was unlocked. I opened it and stepped in. The only light in the room came from the television, which was turned up extremely loud. Facing me when I entered was the old portrait of Patriarch Athenagoras that Desdemona had saved from the yard sale years ago. In a birdcage by the window, a green parakeet, the last surviving member of my grandparents' former aviary, was moving back and forth on its balsa wood perch. Other familiar objects and furnishings were still in evidence. Lefty's Rebetica records, the brass coffee table, and, of course, the silkworm box, sitting in the middle of the engraved circular top. The box was now so stuffed with mementos it wouldn't shut. Inside were snapshots, old letters, precious buttons, worry beads. Somewhere below all that, I knew, were two long braids of hair tied with crumbling black ribbons and a wedding crown made of ship's rope. I wanted to look at these things, but as I stepped farther into the room, my attention was diverted by the grand spectacle on the bed. Desdemona was propped up regally against a beige corduroy cushion known as a husband. The arms of this cushion encircled her. Protruding from the elastic pocket on the outside of one arm was an aspirator, along with two or three pill bottles. Desdemona was in a pale white nightgown, the bed covers pulled up to her waist, and in her lap sat one of her Turkish atrocity fans. None of this was surprising. It was what Desdemona had done with her hair that shocked me. On hearing about Milton's death, she had removed her hairnet, tearing at the masses of hair that tumbled down. Her hair was completely gray, but still very fine, and in the light coming from the television, it appeared to be almost blonde. The hair fell over her shoulders and spread out over her body like the hair of Botticelli's Venus. The face, framed by this astonishing cascade, however, was not that of a beautiful young woman, but that of an old widow, with a square head and dried-out mouth. In the unmoving air of the room, and the smell of medicine and skin salves, I could feel the weight of the time she had spent in this bed waiting and hoping to die. I'm not sure, with a grandmother like mine, if you can ever become a true American in the sense of believing that life is about the pursuit of happiness. The lesson of Desdemona's suffering and rejection of life insisted that old age would not continue the manifold pleasures of youth, but would instead be a long trial that slowly robbed life of even its smallest, simplest joys. Everyone struggles against despair, but it always wins in the end. It has to. It's the thing that lets us say goodbye. As I was standing there taking my grandmother in, Desdemona suddenly turned her head and noticed me. Her hand went up to her breast. With a frightened expression, she reared back into her pillows and shouted, "Lefty!" Now I was the one who was shocked. "No, Yaya. It's not Papu. It's me. Cal."
"Who?"
"Cal," I paused.
"Your grandson."
This wasn't fair, of course. Desdemona's memory was no longer sharp, but I wasn't helping her out any.
"Cal? They called me Calliope when I was little."
"You look like my Lefty," she said.
"I do?"
"I thought you were my husband, coming to take me to heaven." She laughed for the first time. "I'm Milton Tessie's kid." As quickly as it had come, the humor left Desdemona's face, and she looked sad and apologetic.
"I'm sorry. I don't remember you, honey."
"I brought you these." I held out the Epsom salts and baklava.
Why Tessie isn't coming?
She has to get dressed.
Dressed? For why?
For the funeral. Desdemona gave a cry and clutched her breast again.
Who died?
I didn't answer. Instead, I turned down the volume on the television, then, pointing at the birdcage, I said, I remember.